from the Palmetto Swamps to the Piney Woods to the Oak Flats, you're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast.
You're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast, presented by Relentless Boats, custom aluminum fabrication boat builder right down in Thibodaux. All the features and designs that you would expect from a boat maker right there on the South Louisiana Marsh. So live relentless, boat relentless, and check out relentlessboatsla.com. So, Kyler, here we are, episode 59, and getting right into that Christmas spirit. You got your jingle bells on?
My wife is actually making jingle bell little visors for my kids' class right now. So I guess yes.
Yeah. So it's as you're listening to this episode of the podcast, we will be like a week away from Christmas, like the week
That's
before.
Right.
So the Christmas season is upon us. That means the deer should be rutting in a large majority of our listening area. And, you know, we always talk a little bit and conversate a little bit in the intro, and it's kind of a little bit monotonous right now. It's like wait for the weather pattern, do your reconnaissance, kind of know your scouting, and try to hunt the right spots on the right days and hope that the deer aren't locked down with the doe, hope that they're up cruising around and all that kind of sort of thing. I have to make one admission. I today got in the mail something that we've talked about a few times on the podcast, and it gets talked about a lot around bow hunting, and I have never gotten into it until today. Do you want to guess what that product might be?
I have no idea. I'm literally racking my brain. I have no idea what you're about to tell me. I also don't know if you're serious.
I'm serious. No, I'm very serious.
Okay, because that's I would preface something that way and totally be joking.
Not. I'm very serious. So today in the mail, I got the Scentlock version of the Odor Destroyer Radial Nano Ozone Generator.
Okay.
And this is Scentlock's version of the Ozonics, and the difference between this and an Ozonics that you have the tree bracket that you screw into the tree and mount above you, and it distributes the ozone, you know, over the top of you while you're sitting in your stand. This is like, the best way I can describe it is it looks like a really big, like, what would you call, like a toy or a really big sort of novelty, like 44 Magnum bullet.
Like,
so it's like a Coke can size, but it's got a kind of a rounded head tip to it like a bullet would have, and then it's got a base, kind of a base to it, and it's got a lanyard tether rope thing that connects to the bottom. So instead of the larger kind of like book type form of the ozone or the ozonics that you carry the bracket and screw in the tree and all that, it's just a little canister thing, and you just hang it from a bow hook or hang it from a limb, and it's radial. So it's got ports all around the head of it, and it just distributes ozone in every direction.
So you bought this, or somebody sent it to you,
I bought it because my dad has this one spot on our property that he loves to hunt, but it's kind of in a bowl. So like on... if you can imagine this kind of circular food plot, not really big, but pretty much a circle. And three quarters of that circle, more than a half moon, all like three quarters of that circle is a bowl. Like it's a ridge that wraps all the way around it. Like there's two or three ridges that kind of tie in and make it like a bowl. And then on the flat other side, the last quarter side, is a big creek bottom. So the wind is always just, you cannot predict it. It like, you literally can sit there on a windy day and watch the leaves blow one direction across the plot and turn around and blow right back the other direction, because the wind just swirls all around inside that bowl and then dives off in that creek bottom. So I go to the camp last week or so, and he's like, I hate to admit this because he's just never been a gadgety kind of person when it comes to hunting stuff. He's like, I stopped at the sporting goods store and I bought this thing so he could hang it out of his stick. Because he's just like, he's committed to hunting this spot, but every time he hunts there, the deer smell him, no matter what way the wind's blowing, no matter what's going on. And I was looking at the one he bought. There's one that's a little bit bigger. Mine's the Nano, and then the one he got, I don't know what it's called, but it's basically the exact same thing. It's just a little bit larger. So I guess it's a little more powerful, maybe a longer battery life or something. And I thought it was a really neat product, and I found it on sale on Amazon for like $150, normally like $225 or something. And I thought, I'm going to try this because I'm going to go hunt with my son quite a few times over the next several days, and there's going to be two of us up in the tree. And I thought, let's give it a shot. So for all the conversations we've had about ozone and how it works, and people ask it all the time, ask me about this, like, hey, do you use that thing? What do you think about it? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I use it in my little scent crusher closet in my shop where I like put my clothes in there and turn it on, but I've never used it in a tree. So, we'll see. I will follow
so you
up.
You didn't feel like building one from scratch like I did a couple years ago?
No, I did not. I do not have that sort of whatever it is that makes you want to modify and build things like that. I'm just more along the lines of Amazon does a great job of like 2-day prime shipping, and I don't have to do any of that. So anyway.
Well, I got asked again. It was specifically about an ozonic, but I mean, it's ozone is ozone. But I got asked last week, I think, by Justin Johnson up in Northeast. He's in Dennis Springs. He hunts like north of Baton Rouge a good ways, and he asked me my opinion on ozone, and I have to be honest, I haven't used my ozonics in at least 2 years. Not for any reason other than the fact that it's just like kind of cumbersome to bring in, and I've kind of been in the mode of cutting down on gear and weight, and I've also made more of a deliberate effort to put my bad wind side in a direction that a deer can't come from, like, you know, a bayou, a body of water, or, you know, the way that I walked in from or something. And my answer to him, very honestly, was I said, I cannot tell you explicitly that it works, but I can tell you explicitly that I have never been hurt by it. And that's kind of an in-between answer. That's not, you know, that, and I'm trying to be honest there, because especially in the hunting world, everything's so over the top, hardcore sale, like definitive answers, like, yeah, you know, if you use X, you'll kill all the big deer. Or like, look at like things like the extinguisher grunt call. Like, you're going to start calling in $70 with this thing and that type of stuff. And so I told him as honestly as I could, I said, you know, in all the times I've used it, I can tell you for a fact that I have had some deer come from downwind unspooked, but I can't tell you through 100 hunts and 100 sample sizes of data that yes, this helped me. I said, the thing that I brought it for and the thing that you should probably be keeping in mind about ozone in general is that it is a very temporary insurance policy. It is not an invisibility cloak. And that's how I've always viewed it. It does not make you invisible scent-wise. It will make a deer, if they smell you, not bolt immediately because they're kind of confused and never smelled anything like that. I need to break mine back out. I haven't used mine in a while.
Well, what you said was the only reason, and I found it on a really good sale, is the only reason, like, the reason I have not done it is because I have hunted I filmed someone who brought one to the stand and hung it in the tree. So I've actually been in the tree with one. But, you know, the reason I haven't done it is because of the same reason that you just mentioned, bulk. And the ozonic, as it is, it has a larger, heavier battery. It's a larger form factor piece of equipment. You have the attachment to put it in the tree. And I'm already packing in camera gear and all that stuff for the way that I hunt. And I just have not been able to convince myself that I had room to add it to my arsenal. And when my dad showed up at the camp with this thing, and then I got to researching it, and I found that, hey, they've got another one. And it literally is, it's the equivalent of you taking a regular can of Coke, a full can, weight-wise, a full can of Coke, and size-wise, a can of Coke, just a regular can of soda, and putting it in your pack. That's all it is. And it may not work as well. I don't know, but I'm willing to try it. So I'm going to update everyone in the coming weeks about what I think of this thing. It is my mission to now provide podcast content on research and development of this radial ozone scent destroyer. So that's what I'm doing. So we have a fact, data, interesting packed episode in line for you, and we're not going to beleaguer that point much longer. And Kyler's actually going to tell us about our guest and what we're talking about today. And before we do that, remind you about ScreeGear.com. They're actually continuing and pushing even harder to sell off all the Mountain Stealth pattern gear with that camo pattern being discontinued at the first of the year. So 30 to 50% off. You can find a tab right there on the website that says Stealth Clearance or something to that effect, and you'll find all kind of great deals. Great opportunity to finish out your layering system if you're already wearing Mountain Stealth with pieces that you may not be able to get again, or if you've just been looking to try out some pieces of this style of gear and check out Scree specifically. This is a great chance to do it at a seriously discounted rate. And the thing that Scree is becoming most known for is their authentic lifetime warranty, and the lifetime warranty still applies even on these items that are being discontinued. So check them out at ScreeGear.com. That's S-K-R-E, ScreeGear.com. So moving on to the heart of our episode, Kyler, tell us about what we're gonna talk about today.
So I'll get a little deep here for a second. And the way that we got to the topic of this episode and our guests, plural, two guests tonight, is it came about one of my favorite ways that things happen in life, which is very unexpectedly and linearly. What I mean by linearly is there are things in your life, like everybody listening right now, who you married, where you went to school, you know, where you hunt, why you live in the city you do. There are direct reasons as to how you got to exactly where you're standing right now, backtracked to 25 other decisions you've made in the past. Just a very linear, chronological series of events that got you to exactly where you are today. And what's so incredible about that that thought is that oftentimes we do things and we get a totally different outcome than what we intended on. And so anybody that's been listening to the podcast, or especially if you know me personally, I have an unusual sense of humor. I have a drive that I love to, you know, flex as often as I can. And we released three different shirts this year that are just kind of funny spellings of some of the most commonly misspelled or mispronounced pieces of public land in the state. We did a Sherburne shirt, which is like, you know, five or six different ways that people spell Sherburne on the internet or on Facebook or whatever. And what it is, it's the six wrong misspellings, and at the very bottom it's the correct one with an asterisk. And then we did one for Tinsaw, and then we did one for Thistlethwaite. And those three are the ones that I see most misspelled most frequently. So we created these shirts, and I had a couple hundred of them made, and this has been in the works for a long, long time. I've wanted to do this for a long time. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, go to LouisianaBowhunter.com, go to the shirts section, and you'll see what I mean. Well, so I launched them on the website, and then all of a sudden I push them on social media, and all of a sudden, like four or five different people with the last name Thistlethwaite start buying them. And that's the first people that kind of like really latched on to it. And then I got an order, and in the order notes, it said, "We love these shirts, family, owns Thistleway WMA. We lease it to the state. Everybody gets our name wrong all the time, et cetera, et cetera. We think this is hilarious. Thank you so much. And back to that whole linear thing I was talking about a minute ago, this was just a joke, like just a rib jab. It's like, hey, this is how we all spell it wrong. Here's how it's spelled correctly, just kind of a joke. And then here we are with an entire family that has kind of dealt their whole lives, I guess, with getting their name misspelled, that are laughing at these shirts, buying them all. And so I talked to her. She mentions that her dad was, in her words, she really enjoyed history and kind of being a historian on the property and amongst other things. And so he and I spoke. And so tonight we have Patrick Thistlewaite and his second cousin, Lawrence Thistlewaite, on the phone, and he's going to be telling us about Thistlewaite WMA, which the first piece of information about it is that the state doesn't own it. I did not know this before we made these shirts. And so, Patrick and Lawrence, thank y'all for joining us tonight. I appreciate y'all coming on.
Glad to be here.
Well, so, like I said, the first thing that was most surprising to me was, as hunters, we see public land or we see a WMA and we assume it's state owned or federally owned, potentially, if it's an NWR. And so when it's your daughter that I was speaking to originally, when she told me that y'all lease it to the state, that was really interesting to me, and it had me wondering, what else don't we know about this property and other properties? And so you and I spoke. You've been doing research for quite a while, just on facts about it. So start off, Patrick, if you don't mind, kind of tell us about your family history with that property.
Yes. Well, this wildlife management area is a lease, but unlike other leases, it's a free lease. We've received no monies for this lease. The lease was first made in 1966. Family members composing the Thistlewaite Lumber Company made this lease to the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. And in 1977, those people formed a partnership which presently exists called Thisco. This land is family owned. In other words, it's not owned by some investment group or a large business that may be interested in using it for other purposes than it's used presently. So we're very happy to be receiving the cooperation of the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, and they listen to our concerns when we have them. They usually work out a good resolution. We work very well together with the department, and in the end, it benefits the people who are hunters and visitors to that area.
Well, so y'all, you said it's been leased since 1966. What is the renewal period of the lease?
Well, because our legal papers in Thisco say managing partners cannot make a lease longer than 10 years, this needs to be renewed every 10 years. And as a matter of fact, just this past Monday, we were at the headquarters in Lafayette, meeting with the commissioner and other representatives, and we renewed the lease for another 10 years. In other words, we renewed it on December the 7th, and that lease will be in effect for 10 years. And as far as I'm concerned, we intend to lease it after those 10 years are up. Just continue to lease the property, because it works so well for what it's intended, and we're still able to reserve some use of the property, such as growing trees and other things that may exist above the surface or below the surface of the ground. But it's a good combination of the public enjoying the land as well as the family members.
So, to be totally honest, I've personally never been in Thistlewaite. I've never hunted the jungle, hunted around it, hunted near it. How many acres is it in total?
Well, there's a sign as you enter the one of the gates, so it says it's 11,100 acres. And the interesting thing is that all of these acres are contiguous. They're all contained in the same area. You don't have to cross a fence to get to another part of the wildlife management area. And it, for those of you who don't know where it's located, many of you have been there, I'm sure, but it's about 4 miles northeast of the little town of Washington, Louisiana, Washington. And it's nicely situated sort of in the center of Louisiana, making it easy for northerners to come down or people from the south to come up. We're very lucky to have Interstate 49 pass very close to it. In fact, if you go on Interstate 49, so you're going to Washington, you'll take an exit on a road called Louisiana 10, LA 10, and then you'll travel about 2 miles, and you'll come to a road called Plant Road, which is the main entrance. Plant Road is the main entrance to the wildlife management area that takes you to the inside of the wooded area. It's just one main entrance that's intended to be used by the people who go there hunting.
Gotcha. You had mentioned a lot of road access through the property. Can you tell me about the significance of those roads and if that's something that's a state expense that they maintain or if that's something that y'all are required to maintain?
No. The roads are strictly non-state roads. They're private roads. They're maintained. In this case, the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries does a very good job of assisting to maintain the roads from applying some 300 tons of limestone in the last 5 years to grading the road. The roads are not just one road in and one road out. It's like a spider web. The roads go all to all, because this was formerly an oil field. It's no longer an oil field. There is an underground storage facility on the property. But there are many roads that go to different parts of the area, making it easy to go to the desired hunting location.
Gotcha. Okay. I wasn't sure if that was something that y'all maintained or they did.
It's maintained privately
between you and the state then.
Repeat that, please.
I'm sorry. I think we talked over each other. I apologize. What is the agreement between Louisiana and the Thistlewaite family?
I know that you have repeatedly mentioned that it's a great deal for both of y'all.
Are y'all kind of not having to handle the upkeep of it, or is there a tax incentive for it? Because obviously, for a paid lease, it seems obviously great for the state. I'm just kind of curious what the state has taken over as far as land management for.
The number one advantage of having the department as the lessee enjoy the benefits of the area is that they maintain the hunting and in charge of the people who hunt there. They actually keep records, which I may discuss later, of the number of hunters and what they're hunting and what to kill is. And as you probably know, they're using self-clearing permits now, either little cards or phone apps to enter the information that you're going in and you came out and whether you were successful in getting something. But the Wildlife and Fisheries Commission does more than just oversee the hunters, and they also have they monitor duck boxes. They do vegetation control. They help hog trapping, because hogs are something that we don't desire for our purposes or hunting purposes. They mark boundaries. They do beaver trapping. They have research there, allow research, collecting biological data, and they do the trail and road maintenance. And there are about 10 handicapped roads that go into the woods for those people who can't walk, and they maintain those paths in the area so that people can access hunting deeper into the woods by riding in, for instance, a four-wheeler. It's the biggest problem that they've been working with us on, I think, at this time is the hog problem, because the hogs tear up the woods, they eat the crops, which Lawrence can dwell on, I'm sure, and also beaver have been a problem too in there, because they clog up the drainage and cause high water, which is presently a problem we have in high water at this time. So we they do a lot as being partners in this area.
Well, so as someone, as someone who I've also never hunted at this await, I've actually never been on the property. Can you tell us just kind of a brief overview of geographically for people who haven't been there? You know, what the property looks like in terms of how much diversity does it have in its timber and all that. Like, what do you expect to see when you venture around this await?
Well, I could tell you, but I'm going to ask Lawrence to go ahead and describe it, because he probably sees it more often than I do. I'm very familiar with it, but Lawrence, I'll hand that over to you.
Okay. Well, you can basically expect to see a typical hardwood bottom, tall palmettos, briars, cypress sloughs, no pine trees, but just overall just a typical hardwood bottomland forest.
Yeah. So it's pretty flat.
It's flat for the most part, with some ridges, low areas, some swampy areas, but you know, it's pretty much a typical hardwood bottom forest. Okay.
It sounds like my kind of place.
With a really outstanding stand of palmettos,
cool.
Which makes it difficult.
Patrick, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that this is primarily bottomland hardwood area, which is very, very good habitat for deer, I understand, as opposed to maybe piney forest. Another advantage of this area is that selective cutting of some of the trees, not clear cutting, but just selective cutting, and not the whole area, but just portions of that area, are occasionally thinned of timber and sold. And this is a great advantage for the to attract deer, because when the trees are gone, the undergrowth can come up and they have feeding material. Unfortunately, it also brings on palmettos, which allow the deer to be more easily hidden from view. But they seem to survive, and I understand that some of the largest deer in the state are taken from this area.
How long has it been in your family? Can you remind me?
The property was probably obtained by a great grandfather, probably in the early 1900s, and it was obtained primarily by my great grandfather for the harvesting of timber. And they even had a sawmill near Washington that they cut the timber, and that mill was subsequently closed and replaced by a more modern mill in the little town of Opelousas.
I think you said it was early 1900s, so often for about 50 years. What did the property look like when it became a WMA compared to how it looks today? You said it was oil field. Was it clear cut and it's grown up since? I'm kind of curious how it's changed physically over the last 50 years plus.
Lawrence, why don't you go ahead and answer that?
Basically, the woods, as it appears today is how it was 50 or 60 years ago. The logging that's going on in there has been select cut. Now, some hurricanes, as in the Hurricane Gustav, knocked a bunch of trees down that we really had to spend a lot of time picking up to get them out, not to lose them. But basically, the forest is, has been the same since, I would imagine, our ancestors got it, because it was strictly for timber and large timber.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's, you don't see that pretty much anywhere these days. That's really awesome.
Well, we hope to keep it that way for many years to come. We cut trees, but we leave trees to continue to grow and come back possibly 15, maybe 20 years later and cut that area again. So that's what's called selective cutting of timber.
What's your future plans for the property, Patrick?
Well, the future plans is to keep on going as we have since 1966. It'd be my wish, if I'm still around in 10 years, to renew the lease. We just think that we would rather grow trees and see an airport put there or see a solar farm put there and destroy that would thereby destroy the hunting potential. So we hope to keep it just as forested as it is right now, and allow the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries Commission to continue to partner with us in providing this land to the public as a service to the public.
Well, I know that many of our listeners and a lot of the followers, a lot of the bow hunters in the state, are extremely gracious for y'all allowing us to hunt it, especially as a public service like that. I need to get over there and hunt it. I was mainly living in Baton Rouge, driving to Opelousas a little further than Sherburne when I was hunting that area. But I'd like to hunt it sometime soon. That does bring up what you said about the future, you know, keeping the lease going and continuing it for the next 10, at least 20, 30 years or so. That brings up an interesting point of what was Lafayette in 1966? What was Baton Rouge like in 1966? What was even Washington like in 1966? And the reason why I say that is because one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, do you, as the state and as the country grows in population and we move outward from cities, Have y'all ever considered the fact that y'all maybe one day, it might be 50 or 100 years from now, y'all could potentially be one of the few privately owned large tracts of land that is not inundated with progression of cities, if that makes sense? Is that something that's ever crossed your mind?
Yeah, I would hate to see it turn into a residential section, and I'd like to be able to stay there for people to hunt. 95% of the visitors are hunting, but they have some 18,000 visits to that area, at least last year, 2019, 2020, and many of these people were scouting, bird watching, sightseeing. Of course, maybe some of these things you don't want to do while guns and bows and arrows are flying, but when they're not, it's used for other purposes that people may want to employ.
Maybe I'm a little bit nostalgic in this, but it piques my interest as a father with young children and raising them in an outdoor kind of lifestyle. It piques my interest, you know, from the concept of what you're doing, what you're providing through the partnership with the department is for younger kids that are growing up nowadays on the outskirts of larger metropolitan areas. They've probably never seen, at least not in the South, they've probably never seen nature in its purest form, really managed to be exactly what it was in 1950 or 1960. And, you know, outside of the hunting opportunities and the fact that that virgin swamp bottom land is really good habitat for all the different animals that we like to hunt. You know, just simply being able to take someone there and show them this is what it looked like before everybody started cutting down all their trees and planting pines and before we started building neighborhoods everywhere. I think that that's just a really cool thing that you guys are offering outside of the hunting opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yes. There's actually a youth hunting two-day period every year where the youth are invited to come hunt. I'm not sure about the mechanics of that. I've never gone and done it. Maybe Lawrence can talk about that. But just very interesting that in the year 2019-2020, there were 3,045 archery hunters that visited the area, just exceeded slightly by modern firearms carriers, which was 3,789. So about 700 more people were carrying guns than the people carrying bow and arrows. I thought there would have been more modern firearm hunters over there. There were some other primitive firearms hunters there, but there is a special effort made by the department to interest the kids by having a youth hunt. Unfortunately, in the years I mentioned, there were no deer killed. There was a bit of high water, I understand. But as always, that youth hunt will be carried on in the future, as far as I know.
Do you have the statistic, the deer harvest statistics over the last few years? What kind of harvest rate is happening?
I do. Now I don't have this year because the season's still going on. But according the harvest summary for 2019 and 2020. On that 11,100 acres, there were 124 bucks harvested, 124. There were 68 does taken. That means a total of 192 deer taken from the that area. And the weight, I see the weight here for 5.5-year-old bucks was 190 pounds. Now, Lawrence has mentioned the other day that he's seen and heard of larger bucks than that come out. He might want to add to the harvest summary.
So, well, I think the largest buck that I know of was a 333-pound
good grief.
Deer that came off of there.
In Louisiana?
Yes.
Was it obese?
Is it?
No, and it's kind of common in this area. Some of the neighboring clubs have had over 300 pound deer killed.
Wow.
But nothing lately, but we've had several deer over 300 pounds killed in this area.
Wow.
So if you, I was crunching some numbers while y'all were talking a second ago. You said there's 18,000 visitors. I'm positive that a lot of those are the same people checking in and out multiple times, especially if there's only 67 hunters or 67 hunter offers in there in a season. But if you divide that number of deer taken between bucks and does by the number of bow hunters and rifle hunters, you have about a 2.9% success rate.
That seems bleak, but that to your point, I mean, how many people in that, specifically people that are more local to the area, that may be the only place they hunt. They may be going in and out 20, 30 times, just one person.
Yeah.
So that's
exactly
number to figure.
Something else that's interesting, and of course the number can't be divided evenly like this, but if you have 18,000 visits to the site, that's 120 per day every day of the year. I'm sorry, that's not correct. That's 50 per day every day of the year. And if you divide it by just the days of hunting season, October through the end of January, 5 months, then you're at about 120 visits per day on that property is what it averages out to.
Interesting.
18,000 sounds like a very high number to me.
Yeah, and I mean, well, let's take me. Let's pretend I'm a deer hunter in that area. I'm going to scout it in September or August, and I might sign in 5 or 6 times. Then I'm going to come hunt it 10 or 15, 20 times during the season. So, you know, we might actually be talking about a true core number of individual hunters, less than 3,000 to 5,000 people, you know, just checking in multiple times. I guess that's something that we don't really have. I would doubt that you have the individual hunter data on that. I think you would more have the more aggregate stats of activity. Am I right?
That's what I have for the year 2019-2020 is a number of hunters, waterfowl hunters, small game hunters that went into the area. I didn't total that amount, but it's nowhere near 18,000. But that's the number that I had in the report that Regional Director Tony Vidrine gave me.
Tony's great, by the way. He's my friend Nick Vidrine's dad. Tony's a fantastic guy. I don't know all the properties that he manages or he is over, but I know for a fact he's over this way in Sherburn, but I think he's over a few more, if I'm not mistaken.
So one thing that kind of comes to mind when we're talking about how to separate these numbers and make sense of them, are there any, like, events that take place there in the off season? Obviously, that would probably not be something that happened during the season with people out there hunting and firearms and all that. But, you know, I know a lot of places they'll have kids camps and educational opportunities and different things like that. Are they doing things like that at Thistlewaite that could drive that number up where you may have 100 or so visitors just over one weekend for one specific purpose?
Lawrence, are you aware of anything?
Well, they do have hunter education classes that go on back there. And then they do their shooting for the hunter ed class. So they might have a class that goes on Friday night, Saturday, and then they finish up on Sunday. So you'll have 3 days of visiting. So you know, you could have 25 or 30 kids getting their hunter education certificate with their parent or parents 3 days in a row. So that's all separate check-ins and check-outs. So
yeah,
that's how your numbers can go up.
Yeah, that's what I was, you know, I know in other places that's pretty common. You know, the hunter's ed is one of the main things that comes to mind, but other things like, you know, the departments in other states as well will, you know, they'll do lots of different things in the off season to sort of engage with the public and get kids and new hunters and new outdoorsmen involved by fishing rodeos and hunter's ed, as we mentioned, and things like that. So I wondered about that. But yeah, that number seems high, but I guess kind of the ball starts rolling downhill and those check-in, check-outs start to add up pretty quickly.
Right, and there's also quite a bit of fishing that goes on in there during once the hunting season is over with.
Yeah.
There's bayous, and they have actually a pond back there, a stocked pond, that gets a lot of attention. So there's a lot of kids fishing out there with their parents in that pond, so summer afternoons, there's always quite a few people in there.
I have a question that we haven't really defined in this conversation, and I think maybe people that are listening may also. It sounds to me like, Lawrence, you kind of have a different, I guess, role or approach with the property. What is it? What is your relationship to the property as opposed to Patrick's?
Well, I farm a lot of the other family land, and I'm in that management area probably 5 out of 7 days a week. So I get to see the wildlife all year, people going and coming, because I farm everything around there. So I see people going and coming all day.
So how much land does the family have outside of the management area?
Well, it's quite a bit, but it's not all tied up into one company. The family is a little bit diverse, so.
I got you.
But we have a farming operation as well, so.
Okay.
Lawrence, what's the hog situation like as a farmer in that area?
It's very bad, very bad. We when we get to getting in the field in the spring, we're hunting somebody's usually on the property at night, every night, with thermal scopes, and I have Wildlife and Fisheries has some automatic traps that they're using, and myself and a federal hog man and one other guy, we take turns at night. About every three nights, you go, I go, he goes, and they are very bad. I don't know how many we killed, but it's a high number. And that seems to be moving. They're moving out, and like people I've heard say that they didn't have hogs last year, and they're full of hogs this year. So it's a bad problem.
Are y'all using any contract service like Ruger or Hog Control or anything like that to help keep it in check?
No, we're using the state wildlife and fisheries and the federal USDA with their traps, as well as the wildlife and fisheries, and then night hog control between the three of us. We don't have any. Try to keep the access to the property limited for safety and that type of thing.
Gotcha. Are you familiar with Shane Kessler or Rigaroo Hog Control? Have you ever heard of him or them?
No, I haven't.
Okay. We did a podcast with him last year, and what he does is exactly what y'all are doing at night, which is he just has access to properties all over the central part of the state, and just he has a crew of people, and if they find a sounder of hogs, they'll obviously only shoot them where they have permission, but they will take out between 5 and 25 hogs out of a sounder between his crew of people and their rifles. It's really interesting to watch their videos that they capture through the thermal imaging, because it's incredible to watch 20 hogs scatter and then 20 hogs laying dead about 8 seconds later in the field. It's really, and like none of them get away. It's really impressive. So, as far as trapping goes, have y'all noticed a shift in their behavior towards traps? Are they avoiding them now? Or are you still catching them regularly? How does that look?
Well, the traps that they're using are the large circle traps with the gates that are operated through the telephones.
Mm-hmm.
The little small traps are almost impossible to catch a pig in because they've gotten smart to those. But the big traps are still work pretty well. We've caught up to 38 at one time in the trap.
That's a
So we're doing that and shooting and doing the best we can with what we got to work with. Just the amounts we're killing, if we didn't shoot those in 1 year, that would be three times the amount of pigs you'd have.
Sure. Yeah, I've been told that you've got to kill 70% of the current population to keep it from growing.
Right. Hmm. And I don't know if it's not higher than that.
Yeah.
The percentage.
Well, then, I'd like to ask you this, then. I'd like to ask your opinion, because there's a lot of, you know, people that have no ties to public land feel differently about this. But in your opinion, do you think that hog hunting at night on the WMA is something that the state should allow to get the hog population under control, since it is your land?
I think that would be a big safety concern.
Mm-hmm.
If it would be done, which it is being done there now, but it's being done by the government personnel. But if you just turned a bunch of people loose in there, I think you'd have a safety issue, which is what we don't want.
I think you would almost have to. The only way I think that they could legitimately institute a system like that would be in a controlled situation, like a lottery or a draw, where they could control the number of people and how they were accessing it at night. They couldn't. There's no way they could just simply open it up and say, hey, it's public use. If you want to come hog hunt at night, come on. There's just
that's
impossible from a safety perspective, from my point of view.
Well, like I said, you know, my opinion on it, actually, we talked to a biologist many episodes ago, Betsy Dutrois, who has the same request from a lot of people for Kisatchie National Forest, and then a couple other, Tensaw also. And her concern from a biologist standpoint is that the wildlife outside of pigs never would have a moment of reprieve. Like, they would never be left alone, day or night. And that would cause stress issues, especially if it was something that was opened up on an annual basis or outside of deer season. And then there's, outside of the safety issue of the people doing it, there's also the extreme possibility of people seeing record-sized deer and bucks through their thermals at night and shooting them and trying to extract them in secret. I'm not saying that everybody would do that, but you know for a fact, somebody sees a 180-inch buck at 3 a.m. with a thermal, somebody's going to pull that trigger, you know. And so it's a very slippery slope, and that's why I was wondering your opinion on it, being the landowner, what, you know, your thought might be on it, because you seem to be on both sides of it. You own the property, so you obviously have safety concerns too and liability, but then on the other hand, you're also the victim of a huge hog problem. So I was just curious about your stance on that.
Right, and the hog problem is not something we started or anybody particularly started, but I just think you'd have it would be an enforcement nightmare for the game wardens to try to enforce all these people in and out and shooting, and just like you said, somebody will shoot a deer. It's gonna happen. Because they just can't help themselves, and then...
Yeah. So the other thing that gets talked about in this conversation a lot, too, is it happens even in the daylight. With the increased bear population all across the state, people shooting bears thinking that they're shooting hogs, which
didn't even think about that.
Which is, that's a problem even in low-light, regular hunting situations. Those mistakes happen. It very obviously would happen with thermal. So that just brings up the question, is there a bear population at Thistlewaite that has been reported or that you've noted or anything?
There are several bears around. I can't honestly say if I've heard of anything in the management area, but in the hunting clubs surrounding the management area, there are sightings of bear in those clubs. But they don't tend to stay long. You see them in there, and then a couple of weeks, and then they move on.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like you have a pretty good rapport with the neighboring properties and hunting clubs and stuff like that. I guess you talk to those people on a regular basis.
Yeah, much of the property belongs to Thisco, to the same company, and we have hunting clubs on that property. So naturally, Lawrence keeps in close touch with them and hears what they're getting and what they're seeing, because it is our property.
Oh, okay.
Besides the management area, we maintain 20 hunting clubs. Of various sizes, so
you got a pretty big
operation. We're in touch with a lot of people.
You got a pretty big operation on your hand.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you this: what would y'all like to see hunters and users of the property do a better job of as we use your property as a public service?
I think things are going well the way they are. Lawrence, you have any ideas?
Yeah, it's a it's going fine. I mean, you have your issues with people hunting where they're not supposed to be, venturing out of the boundary, and we usually just make a call to the enforcement division, or I'm friends with most of this area, game wardens, and it's handled. No charges usually are issued. Just people just need to be aware of where they're hunting as compared to when they get out the management area. It's clearly marked by yellow paint and boundaries, and but you always have a few that want to encroach on something else. So you just deal with them and move on. But I think everything is fine the way it's going.
That's good. That's good to hear. Well, like I said, I know that many of our listeners and many of the people that bow hunt in the state, they probably before this podcast never knew that it was something that was allowed for them to be to get use from or allowed them to use. They probably, like I was under the impression that it was a state owned property, and et cetera, et cetera. But with it being a lease, you know, that comes with a large amount of gratitude that we have towards y'all and your family for allowing us to hunt it. So we really appreciate that.
But thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Patrick, what have we? Have we missed something that we covered that we talked about before, or is there anything else that maybe we haven't covered that you'd like us and our listeners to know?
Well, yeah, there's one thing that I had no knowledge of when we were at the meeting in Lafayette renewing the lease, and that was a very scarcity of deer some years ago, and I was informed that between the years of 1961 and 1965, a deer, I have a record of 105 deer being placed in that area, and those deer came from Gum Cove, Madison Parish, Tensaw Parish, and Pecan Island. And but I had no idea that the population census had been so low at that time that they had to restock it. And Lawrence had made mention also at that meeting about some of the deer variation in size. You might want to mention that, Lawrence.
Well, the deer, when they were put in there, some of the deer, as Pat said, came from South Louisiana, which Avery Island supplied quite a few, and then Tensaw Parish up in the north. So you have two, I guess, strains of the whitetail deer in there, and you can see it in some of the deer with a longer bodies. The Tensaw deer tend to have a shorter body but a much heavier body. The Avery Island deer are longer, a lot leaner, but so
that's pretty interesting. We have that. There's other parts of the state where that's pretty well documented, and I actually live and hunt in one of those areas in East Feliciana where there's been restocking in the area over the years, as well as the Idlewild LSU deer farm where deer have gotten out of the fence and, you know, commingled with the native deer. And even on my own property right here, there are times where you get a picture of a deer or you see a deer, and it's very obvious that one is not like the other. And it's very interesting how they maintain those genetic features even after years and years of interbreeding.
So, Lawrence, did y'all receive any of the deer that came from up north? I think it was Michigan, Wisconsin. Wisconsin. Which one was Wisconsin?
It was Wisconsin that came here.
Yeah.
Well, they talked about deer from Wisconsin, but I'm really not sure. I know in Tensaw Parish, a lot of Wisconsin deer ended up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten they stocked deer from Tensaw Parish in St. Landry Parish, so it possibly could be some from Wisconsin. I'm not sure.
So we interviewed Jonathan Bordelon, who's the deer. What was his title?
The deer program manager.
Deer program manager. Yeah, well, and We've known about and heard about the restocking efforts in the 50s and 60s for a long time, but he informed us that a lot of the deer that came from far north, Wisconsin, and in that area, that strain of deer, he doesn't believe that the descendants of those deer, if you will, survived and are kind of still prevalent in our current population. He thinks that they struggled to live in our climate and then slowly dwindled themselves out of the population and didn't reproduce at the rate that other more local deer, like you said, the Avery Island, the Tensaw, Madison Parish deer may have. So I was just curious if you knew that y'all had gotten some of those as well.
Yeah, I couldn't say one way or the other on that.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting, guys. Is there anything else that y'all want to cover before we jump off of here?
Nope, I'm good.
Yeah, I think it's been very thorough.
Yeah, you know, we've been talking about this for a few weeks. Patrick, I really appreciate the research and the efforts that you have you've gone through to find out more about the property, get us some great numbers. I was really intrigued about the stats from last year, especially the numbers, the number of gun hunters, the number of bow hunters, the number of deer taken, things like that. Those are I love statistics like that, so I really appreciate you providing those to us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, I think it's funny. I do have to think it's funny that or acknowledge that this all came from a stupid T-shirt, you know, a ridiculous
yeah, which I have one of.
That's great. I love it. A facetious T-shirt that ended up to us learning a lot about one of our state lands or one of our public lands in the state. So anyway, with that being said, thank you both for joining us tonight. And we really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Y'all have a good night. Honey.
Y'all have a good night.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to
you. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast. If you have anybody you'd like to hear on the show, reach out to us at info@louisianabowhunter.com. And if you want to help support Louisiana Bowhunter, go by your local archery shop and pick up some merchandise. If you don't have any at your local shop, let us know and we'll reach out to them. Or pick up your gear at louisianabowhunter.com and we'll ship it out to you same day. See you next week.